I don't know if you know the Devil's Advocates, but they are kind of a big deal.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates, live on the road again. The summer of love continues. We're at Hawks Bar right here on State Street, 400 block. We're on the shady side, the slightly misty side, but the weatherman assures us 9 more minutes of rain, then we're done.
Then we're done.
Nine minutes.
I think the sun's already starting to come out.
And, Dom, we got a fine guest here at the table, James Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours. He brought the cannolis. He came to town. And by the time this segment's done, Jim, I expect the sun will be shining, sir.
The cannolis are fresh, and the sun will be shining just in time to eat all of them.
Excellent.
Jim, I know we've asked for a comment on Afghanistan from you recently, but let's ask you again, Jim. President Biden is obviously under a lot of pressure, and we find out today that his CIA director met with the new Taliban leader in secret. I don't know that the American people should know about the meeting in real time. Obviously, it's not that old news. But is this the proper representative of the U.S. government? And really, is this August 31st? What happens if we don't meet the deadline, Jim?
Sure. A couple of significant things here, as you say. The fact that the CIA director is meeting with the Taliban, obviously at the Kabul airport, very significant. It is, I suppose, a good thing, and we always talked about this when I was in Iraq, again, never in Afghanistan, but Iraq, to have some communications with those people who are in opposition to you. That's always a good thing. If you break off communications entirely, that will lead to bad things. People will probably die or certainly get injured. Those kinds of things will happen.
That's why Dom and I keep talking.
Exactly, right? Communication, conversation is always a good thing. So it's a good signal, and plainly the CIA director would not be meeting with the Taliban absent the president's approval of that. He cannot be seen talking with them directly. But the notion we're in communication with them, we plainly have some huge, as you indicated, logistical problems to solve here. If, in fact, the 31st deadline remains in place, we want to make certain that to the extent we exhaust all options, we've done that with the Taliban to ensure that maybe they will permit safe access by Americans across the city and into the airport, and frankly, even for Afghans coming through. So a good thing, even though, again, we will not get a readout on that for weeks, perhaps months down the road. The 31st, again, I look to all of this. I was in Iraq for a whopping 2 years. The notion of moving out in just a couple of months at that point struck me as an incredible feat to accomplish.
Ambitious.
And after 20 years, again, my own sense is, and not only in terms of moving a physical plant, but especially the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, it strikes me that probably the experts on this are accurate. President doesn't want to go. I'll be out there right now saying we're going to extend the deadline because he wants to keep the pressure on. But don't be surprised if that happens as a practical matter.
And what would happen in response, according to the Taliban? They say consequences. What consequences could possibly be exerted over the United States? Certainly not military consequences. But what's that mean? They're going to hold those that remain behind as hostages?
This is the challenge you always had. You know, when we would go out into the city, when other places throughout Iraq, the concern was if we were apprehended, if we were taken hostage, what kinds of things could happen to you? Of course, the ultimate thing could be you could be killed. There's no doubt about it. We plainly have had civilians and plainly military officials and our servicemen and women overseas who are killed in these kinds of circumstances. The other thing we want to ensure, of course, is we still have tens of thousands of again, Afghans we want to bring to America. We've got reportedly thousands of Americans who are still throughout the country. We want to be able to still bring them into the airport, provide them with safe access back to the United States. And that, again, we've got to make certain we've got a communication going on with the Taliban, even in these difficult times. Plainly, that's one of the things they could stop. If they do plainly have the authority right now, the physical force to stop that from happening, that is a huge bargaining chip. That's a huge thing for them to play on the table with the president.
Jim, did I hear you say you think the Taliban could theoretically hold the Afghanis, the allies of the Americans, as hostages? And I thought I had seen some reporting really expressing that very same concern earlier today. Jim, have you seen that reported that the Taliban are going to effectively block the exit of Afghani nationals?
The latest, of course, we heard this morning was that they're not going to stop the Americans from coming through, perhaps. after the 31st, but certainly the Afghans. And true to their word, we know from history, again, the cousins, if you will, the Taliban were in Iraq. Obviously, we're seeing, again, the emergence of ISIL and ISIS in Afghanistan. They're still in Iraq as well. These are people who are single-minded in terms of their mission. Perhaps that's a good thing for all of us to be, but these people are single-minded in terms of their violent mission, and they will do whatever they need to do to get done what they need to get done in support of their agenda, which is to take over, which is to ensure that what they say goes. And again, we are losing in that part of the world a democratic ally, a democracy, that is, small d, not capital D. That's a huge loss for us, and certainly is something that the Taliban appreciates well. And plainly, we'll be hearing more about that from them as they play these cards in the next few days and weeks.
Well, James Santel, former U.S. attorney, you know, if we got to buy our love and loyalty, what are we really missing out on? You know what I'm saying? Right. If our allies, you know, 300,000 strong, that we trained all these troops and they're ready to embrace democracy, we're exporting democracy, and as soon as it gets hot, they melt into the wilderness or join the Taliban. Well, I mean, that's not really an ally, Jim.
It is not. And plainly, we will not have an ally. We don't have an ally anymore in Afghanistan. The day that the president fled the country, that was done. The government is through. We do not have, unlike Iraq, other places in the Middle East, we do have allies, and they are with us on these kinds of things. Even those who are specifically allies are certainly not our enemies. Now we have an enemy. Who is in charge of this country that we were for the past 20 years in charge of. I'll make the same point that we talked about last time I was with you on this fine program, which is that is the great disappointment of this, that we should have known. We should have known after 20 years that not only in the civilian side, but also the military side, doing the training, doing the engagement with them. When I was in Iraq, we knew who was with us, who wasn't, who was going to support the long-term initiative and who wasn't. There was intelligence, small I, capital I, and the fact that this moved so quickly, it had to be anticipated. People in America, Americans knew that this was going to happen. The president certainly should have been advised that this was going to go that quickly. And now, of course, we're in this situation where we're scrambling in response to that bad situation, but also not appreciating the lack of a level of commitment to a nation that we should have known about for many years.
Jim, let's turn our attention domestically. And I saw a headline last night that really struck me, and I thought of you immediately. The Select January 6th Committee on the Trump terrorist attack on our Capitol. Apparently, they're getting around to maybe, you know, putting out some subpoenas for phone data. And Jim, while I'm down, and I appreciate that, and some of those receiving could be members of Congress. They're going to get this information presumably directly from the different phone companies and whatnot. But, Jim, this seems like a no-brainer to me. Why are we just hearing about this and doing this now? We're 7-8 months past this. Yes, good, but why did it take so long?
Right. It certainly is the first thing that you would sit down and when you've gotten the commission again from the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the commission is in, this committee is in place, the Select Committee is in place. You've been given your marching orders. You sit down right away. Time is not your friend when it comes to these kinds of investigations. In any investigation, this has got to be at the top of the list. Who are you? Who are the focuses? Not necessarily the targets or subjects. Who are the focuses of your investigation? And how do we get their information? Well, we get it a couple of different ways. One is testimony. Plainly, the subpoenas going out there. We're going to hear more about that. We had one day of testimony a couple of weeks ago. Then we go to the technological stuff. And again, we hear that the committee now finally has requested the providers, as you just indicated, Dom, to preserve the records for perhaps as many as 100 people or so. That's a lot of human beings. That even for any white-collar investigation, it is presumable that among those 100, you do have, and yes, this is the big headline, members of Congress, people like Paul Gosar, Mo Brooks, obviously Jim Thompson, others like that.
Kevin McCarthy spoke to the president that day.
Kevin McCarthy, right. I'm sorry. I said Jim Jordan, not Jim Thompson, former governor of Illinois, but not involved in this as far as we know. But all those folks plainly would be on the focus of telephone records. Who it is you're talking to, you have to believe that during the course of those hours when our nation and our capital was under siege, that there were a lot of communications going back and forth. Providers can provide that information. They need to preserve that. I'm hoping that we're just getting news about this now and that, in fact, it was underway for a long period of time. This is going to be a source of a lot of very important information going forward.
Jim, we saw some reporting. Jim Centel, our fine guest, former U.S. attorney, here with us at Hawks. And as promised, the rain's done. But Reuters reported earlier this week, scant evidence of a conspiracy. And, you know, I felt like a Trumpster because I was complaining about the lack of sourcing, just anonymous sources. Jim, how can they say scant evidence of a conspiracy? Certainly there were conspiracies amongst the militias. How did the I felt like Bill Barr should have that byline.
Right, and I was scratching my head, too, as I often do, as we often do when we sit down to talk about these kinds of things. We've got conspiracy, again, with a capital C and with a small c, right? We've talked about what a conspiracy is. You just indicated what one of them is. When people get together and say, listen, let's have this agreement. Let's go to the Capitol. Let's go to the nation's capital, and let's go to the Capitol building itself and break in and undermine the progress of the United States Congress, and we engage in overt acts, which plainly we did. That's a conspiracy. That's a completed conspiracy. I think what they were suggesting in that media reporting, which again is not helpful for the world to understand what's going on, is that not every one of those thousands of people there on that day were part of this particular sort of Jim Centel criminal conspiracy that we describe here. And that's true. There were many people.
But they, sorry to interrupt, sure, Jim, yeah. But they also seemingly gave cover to the Roger Stones and
exactly.
The Alex Jones of the world,
right,
and said, you know, these specific people, and they were named by name in the Reuters reporting, didn't lead a broader conspiracy, didn't lead this attack on the Capitol. And perhaps they individually did not, but what about the president? What about the administration? There's no one that knew this was coming.
Scant evidence means there's evidence. I mean, right, I look at this on the other side of it, and it doesn't matter if there was, you know, I'm only concerned like five or six people, right? The president, McCarthy,
right.
You know, some of these players in the Republican Party, Jordan. When you're talking about, you know, thousands of people, 5 or 10 or 20 is a scant amount of evidence.
Right, and that's enough.
That's enough,
right?
That's all I'm
exactly.
saying.
As I said before, everybody who showed up that day, you did have some people standing around watching this, perhaps
sure.
in horror, and we're not charging those people. But there were enough folks there who were coordinated, who did this agreement, not only from the time of the assembly on the Ellipse, encouraged by the president and Mo Brooks to walk down the street and engage in this kind of behavior, but you had engagements, communications before, and that's what the Roger Stone and Alex Jones stuff is all about. I would offer that's what the president was all about too. And again, the focus of the January 6th Select Committee is going to be not just what happened on that particular day, but also what about all the communications before that, including Dom, the folks that you and Mike just identified. What were we saying on social media? What were we talking about in communications back and forth? All that is a part of the conspiracy. Scant is one of those words that really doesn't have a whole lot of meaning inside legal trappings. We don't evaluate the strength of criminal cases based upon whether the conspiracy is scant or not. If it's there, it is there, and you've committed a crime.
Jim, we got about 90 seconds left in this particular segment. If you were prosecuting this case and you were getting this data, how would you play it? Would you want to see all the data and then bring in McCarthy and ask him questions under oath? I mean, how does that go? Is there give and take on that?
Sure. There's a little bit of give and take on it because you want to get a sense of where some of that material is, right? You want to have somebody come forward and say, well, listen, I had a conversation with Mike and Dom on that particular day. Okay, I didn't know that before. So that gets added to my list to the providers for the information. So you want to do some of that. But that's right. I don't want to call Kevin McCarthy. I don't want to call Jim Jordan yet. More Brooks yet. Why? Because I want to get all the information. I want to see we want to find out what is out there. And then it's not just a game of cat and mouse. It's what you're confronting them with, what the evidence shows, what the documents reflect. And for that reason, you want to call them probably late in the process. And so we're gathering that information right now, anticipating those testimony appearances fairly soon.
And would you call those appearances the kill shot? Is that when you drop the kill shot? James Centel, former U.S. attorney, our good friend. Hopefully that's a current statement. We're at Hawks Bar. We're partying at a bar. Come join us. Got a little cover here. We got a warm, cool inside, depending on your point of view. Good drinks, good eats, and good company. James Centel, stick around. More Devils Advocates on the other side, live from Hawks on State Street.
Leave the gun. technical knowledge.
The Devil's Advocates, tackling the issues you're not allowed to talk about at the dinner table.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show live from Hawks Bar and Grill on State Street in Madison, Wisconsin. Come on down, join us. We're doing the whole show here until 5 o'clock. We will party afterwards. We hope to see all of you shortly.
Dominic, we got a fine guest with us. He's former U.S. attorney, current friend, I hope. He brought cannolis. That's a good sign. He's James Santel. Jim, appreciate you sticking around.
Good to be with you.
Jim, wanted to talk at least in brief about a flurry of lawsuits that are raining down in the redistricting, the future redistricting here in the state of Wisconsin. Jim, we've seen everyone from Law Forward to Voces de la Frontera to Mark Elias to, of course, Republican state legislators. Everybody wants a piece. Everyone wants to direct this lawsuit to where they think it's going to be most beneficial for their cause. Jim, give us the latest, if you could, sir.
Sure. We've got at least three lawsuits pending already. And again, the lines have not yet been drawn. And we'll see, at least not legislatively. We know that this is all about the census recently being information being released in Wisconsin and nationwide. We know, and this is the predicate. This is what joins all three of the lawsuits together. We know, based upon the census information provided, that the lines as they are now drawn would no longer be constitutional.
Right?
There are some, obviously, areas. We've had a small increase in Wisconsin in population, but the population has moved around. So we know that the lines have to change. So on that, all these lawsuits and all the petitioners, all the plaintiffs and the defendants are probably in concurrence. That's where they part company. And so we had the Democratic lawsuit of recent times on behalf of a few Democratic voters who are, again, asking the federal court, running into federal court, saying, we know that the governor and the legislature are not going to concur on this. At least set a timetable for that. And as you most accurately indicated last time, Mike, under the 14th Amendment, invoking the constitutional principles, saying, listen, they're not going to get it together, so federal court, you take responsibility for that. That is, for the most part, what these other two lawsuits are about, one of them filed by the fairly conservative side, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and the other one, as you indicated, on behalf of a block, the League of Women Voters, Voces de la Frontera, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, all of them sort of saying the same thing. The differences are, as you also indicated, where they're headed. The two Democratic, sort of liberal lawsuits going into federal court, the WIIL lawsuit going into the state Supreme Court. First impression, if you will, or at least first shot at this, right to the Supreme Court again, which is going to be a subject of presumably motions to dismiss. Normally we go through lower courts to get there. So that's where we are today. We've got three lawsuits that are being being pursued right now. Different parties, all of them, before the lines have been drawn. Again, not without merit that they're there, but certainly motions to dismiss, I anticipate, based upon, as I said before, standing issues related to whether there's a case in controversy. I couldn't see federal judges and state judges saying, listen, let's at least give the political folks a chance to do this, and if they don't meet this by a certain deadline, then come back. That's a possibility. Other judges could well say, as they did back in 2000, 2001, well, you know what? You're right. Let's at least set a deadline here. Let's make certain that we're not doing these 11th hour, 12th hour decisions in the federal courts, state courts, about how districting should go.
Jim, I got to ask you, I was very confused at the point of the Elias lawsuit. Legislative Republicans from the state of Wisconsin are trying to intervene in that lawsuit. And I said, oh, that's not appropriate. They're already the defendants in the lawsuit, effectively, or at least that's as I would characterize it, but they're not defendants. The Wisconsin Elections Commission is the defendants in this case. So how do legislative Republicans factor in, and why can they intervene on behalf of some other party? How does that work, Jim?
Sure. And so you're absolutely right. All these lawsuits against the Bipartisan Election Commission, that's who the defendant is. And we all know that it's really not, we don't really have an objection to what they're doing. It's just a way of getting these issues before the court. But the issue of intervention happens all the time, and principally in civil cases, which this is, very infrequently in criminal cases, almost never in that type of a setting. But here what you've got to do is you've got to convince a judge, or at least in the case of one of the federal cases, a three-panel now, a set of judges, judges. Diane Sykes has appointed them to say, listen, we have got some interests in this matter that are not being properly advocated for by those parties who are here already. Invite us in. Let us come into this lawsuit. Let us file briefs. Let us file motions. Let us take discovery, because our interests, which are involved in the merits of these cases, are not being properly addressed. That's an issue that, again, judges can sometimes say yes, sometimes say no. And again, that's I'm not surprised that they would seek to intervene. Also not surprised that there will be motions to dismiss on both sides. The issue with the state Supreme Court, anticipate the Democrats will say, well, listen, we already got this thing going on in the federal court. Let's not have multiple jurisdictions here, state and federal jurisdictions looking at this. We're going to get lots of motion practice to intervene, to dismiss in the coming weeks.
Jim, does the fact that we have prior precedent, not 10 years ago, when, of course, Republicans drew the map to a very gerrymandered outcome here in Wisconsin, but the 40 years prior, every 10 years, we had divided governance and we had federal courts drawing the maps. Jim, does that precedent matter? Because Republicans, of course, want the partisan conservative-controlled state Supreme Court here in Wisconsin to make that ruling.
Precedent matters a whole lot. It always does, always will, not only in terms of the substance. That is, again, we can talk about the constitutional principles, which are foremost. We're going to go back and take a look at what other federal courts have done, not just in Wisconsin, but throughout the country, what this Supreme Court has said on this area. So precedent, substantively, hugely important, and also procedurally to the discussion we just had. Under what circumstances have courts permitted other parties to intervene in cases involving line drawing? When is that done? Again, the case about 20 years ago, right around the turn of the century, that's going to be a significant one. My issue about timing of this, is this preemptive, or shouldn't the fact that federal courts say, yes, let's at least entertain this and let's keep it open, or let's see what the legislature does? There's also some precedent procedurally for doing what courts can, in fact, do here once again.
James Santel, former U.S. attorney. We've got about 90 seconds left. Reporting, Igor Fruman. Remember, Levin Igor, really Giuliani's buddy. Reportedly is going to plead guilty to some charges. Does that mean he's rolling over and turning over on Giuliani? And if so, how do we know that?
Sure. A brief entry yesterday in the docket of the court saying that tomorrow, so we can come back and talk about exactly what Igor does tomorrow, likely going to plead guilty to this charge involving illegal donations and the 2020 election campaign, all the things we've talked about before. Highly likely. We haven't heard a lot from Igor. We've heard about Lev Parnas a lot.
Yeah.
Been talking a lot, probably much to the chagrin of his lawyer. But we haven't heard a lot about this fellow. Fully anticipate that part of the agreement, which should be on the record, is going to be cooperation. Not good news for who? For Rudy Giuliani. Not good news probably for the former president of the United States of America.
Because if Igor rolls up on Rudy, Rudy's got no one left to roll up on except the...
Exactly.
The Cheeto Messiah.
Right. Anticipate lots more of that kind of thing going on. A huge revelation tomorrow when we get more merits of what this is all about. Not surprising. You predicted this, frankly, months and months ago. Not at all surprising that they're going to be cooperating and certainly pleading guilty as these cases go forward.
James Santel, former U.S. attorney, current friend. He brought the cannolis. He's at Hawks Bar. Come see him. The party continues until 5 o'clock. More fine guests in the next hour. You can join us on the phones as well. 844-967-2789.
Thanks, Jim.
Always a pleasure.
Will there be a lawsuit? Yeah, probably.
Hi, I'm Roman.